Very good. All right, guys. Thank you all for being able to make it here tonight. We've got a pretty exciting set of presentations to look forward to here. And I'll just do a brief run through of the format for tonight's session and then we'll get started. So basically, we're going to have three presentations to start off with by each of Megan, Belinda and Ross. And then the floor will open to a general Q&A. And I just ask you to wait for one of us to come to you with a microphone so you can ask your question and people listening from home or afterwards can hear the questions and the responses from our panellists here tonight. So without further ado, I might invite Megan to start and introduce yourself.
Oh, thank you. Well, thanks, everybody. It's really great to be here. I was just saying, I was a young actuary once, so it's nice to come back in and share some observations. I know that when I was starting out on my career, that was one of the things that was most valuable to me, was hearing from people who had experienced some of it, and I think you pick up a lot of things along the way. But I think also the one thing I'm really looking forward to is hearing from you guys later and what your questions are, because I know I haven't stopped learning, and so I'm sure I'm going to learn a lot from you tonight as well too. So thank you for having me. So I'm the Group Executive for Insurance at AMP. So at AMP, we've been a life insurer for 148 odd years, and I guess have seen a lot of things that have come and gone in the market. It's a wonderful privilege to be able to lead that business because it's such a great iconic brand. We've served so many customers and helped them in their time of need, and it's one of the greatest things that I get to do every day outside of work. My family is my other greatest thing I do. But it's a real privilege to be able to come into work every day to be thinking about how do we help customers when something doesn't go the way they might have expected, the way they might have hoped. I love leading a team of people who can deliver on that vision. And so if today I thought what I might share with you a few thoughts about strategy and about just how some of the forces that are shaping life insurance that I think about every day and things that we talk about in our team. And I wanted to start off with that purpose about, you know, why I do love coming to work every day, because I think really for me strategy is about sharing that vision and that purpose with everybody so that everything we do every day is aligned to achieving that outcome. So, you know, for me strategy has to start with that higher order purpose. And then coming out of that is, you know, really defining what do we want to be, who do we want to be, how do we want to be seen by our stakeholders. What's fair to say in the last couple of years, particularly in life insurance, is the stakeholders we need to think about have probably increased in intensity and number. So if I think about when I first started my career, you know, thought about ASIC as, well, ASIC went around, but ASIC as the conduct regulator, you know, thinking about what they would be observing around claims experience and the customer experience at claims time was probably something we didn't really contemplate very often. So we've got a lot of scrutiny, consumer expectations are changing, and so that's a stakeholder group we really need to think about when we think about our strategy. We've also just hearing a lot more from customers. You guys don't need to tell me, but you know, the digital revolution, the ability to share information really quickly, the fast feedback loops. There's things being said about us as a provider, as an insurer, and potentially even about some of our employees, is real time, and it's happening out there in such a live way that we really need to be attuned to those customer expectations. And sometimes we can say, they don't really know what they need, but what we do know is their perceptions of us is what our reality will be. So we've got to pay much more attention to that. So they're just a couple of examples of some of the stakeholders that really, for me, strategy is about thinking through all of those lenses. The other one that's really personally important to me is our people and how we think about what the strategy is going to deliver for our people in terms of their growth and development, and also how do we get the best out of people so that they contribute back to that higher order purpose. Because we can put a lot of words on a page about which markets we want to play in, which competitors we want to beat, how we want to, what's our value proposition, how do we want to be seen, and how do we want customers to decide to buy our products and keep them. But really, you know, it's our people who are going to make that happen every day. And so we've got to have that compelling vision that people can come back to every day and think about that. But from a process perspective, you know, we do have to have something written down. We have to have the thing that we all can speak to the metrics. I think that's a great opportunity where actuaries can particularly play a role in quantifying what the strategy might mean and the risks to some of the strategy. I guess one of my experiences working with lots of different people in formulating strategy is some people don't think in numbers. Some people don't think in probability of outcomes and think about what the risks might be that we haven't thought about in this time horizon but could come upon us quite quickly. And I think that's one of the most valuable things that that actuaries can bring to strategic planning process. But having said that, actuaries and our perspective might be just one perspective. And I think the best strategy gets formulated when you have diversity of thought. And so the best strategies, the best approaches to how you want to win and the markets you want to compete in and so forth really come when you get a broad cross-section of people together to think about what the, we've a really well-stressed, tested and thought through strategic plan will be. And that's one of the great things about, again, in really engaging people in that process so that you do get that diversity of thought. So, we go through a process, generally happens, regularly every year, maybe a bit more frequently because the world's changing quite quickly, and really set out what is the arenas that we want to play in. And in insurance, for me, in my career, probably the one thing that I think has been the biggest determinant of whether the outcomes you expect from a strategic perspective will be what you achieve is what parts of the portfolio are you in. It doesn't matter, I think, over what time horizon you look at, where you've chosen to play in the market is the biggest determinant of that. So we can all think about we want the best service, the best product, the cheapest price, the best claims experience, whatever that might be. But if you're on the wrong part of the market, in the wrong part of the cycle, then nothing's going to really help you there. And so I think that's, again, something that, maybe leave with you guys from what perspective can you bring in is to think about how might you bring that portfolio lens to bear, because it's not maybe just even the market, whether it's participating, for example, in retail advised insurance that we participate largely in at AMP, but the types of products, the types of risks that are exposed there that really might be the things that that define the strategy. So what are some of the challenges that we're thinking when we formulate our strategy? There's heaps. And as soon as you think you've got them all written down, there's plenty more that pop up. I think the one that, I think is a real challenge for our industry right now is customer behaviour and the changing health of customers. Too often when I go out and talk to advisors, an example, they talk about, well, premium rates should be coming down because everyone's living longer. And we all know that that's not true, that some people are living longer in some pockets, but many people are living much more stressed lives, impacted more by mental health issues and also not as well. And that's a really big issue when you think about insuring people in a space where it is largely about how they look after their health and what their behavioural attitudes is to looking after their health. And I think that's both a challenge but also a really big untapped opportunity. The opportunity to think about how can we redefine what life insurance looks like to start to think more about how do we help people to look after their health and be proactive rather than reactive when something goes wrong. So I think that's a great opportunity for our industry. The second probably big, and I'm going to do these as challenges and opportunities because I think you can always look through one's lens as a challenge and then see it as an opportunity in the other. The second big one I think is data. I'm sort of admire other parts of the insurance industry who have really nailed this already because we haven't in life insurance. To share with you some examples, we still collect underwriting information when customers apply for life insurance on paper forms. So we've got all this rich data from some of our customers, not all, that we just waste. We've lost a huge ability to actually take that data and develop insights and to really start to think about what are some of the things that are going to shape what are inevitably long-term life insurance contracts. So that's a great opportunity because I think it's an opportunity for us to then start to act differently, but also to really leverage the benefits of that so that we can better develop our offers and our solutions for our customers. And I think that's probably one of the most exciting things that's also to come from a life insurance perspective. I think I've spoken a little bit about consumers. One of the things that I sort of went through most of my career so far, thinking that consumers really valued life insurance, it gave them peace of mind. I don't know how many of you think like that, but, that was sort of an inherent part of, the purpose piece. We've done a lot of consumer research over the last few years, and the one thing that I've learned out of that is we don't give consumers peace of mind in life insurance. They fear that their claim might not get paid. They fear that they've bought the wrong thing. They fear that they're going to claim and that that's a pretty horrible thing to happen. Or they fear that they've paid all this money and they're never going to get anything back. And so, again, that's a big challenge because it means that we're not only customer behaviour about their health is changing, but also as they think about continuing on with our products, you know, they're making different choices. But again, a great opportunity for us to really define how insurance can be done differently. And I thought they might just be three examples of things that are challenges and opportunities. Happy to share some more with you later because, as I said, the list gets longer and longer. But maybe just in the interest of time, I'd leave you sort of with a thought that I think it's everybody's job to be thinking strategically. It's not just the domain of the strategy team or the leadership team. I think it's everyone's role to think about what's the purpose, what am I doing today, and how does that contribute back? And I'd encourage you all to think like that, and I'm sure that lots of opportunities will unfold for you because of that. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Megan. I'd now like to invite Ross to take the podium and continue on the presentation.
Thanks, Cam. So my name's Ross Friedberg, and I've been a part of the strategy team at IAG for about 6 or 7 years now, most recently leading the corporate strategy team over there. I've had a bit of time working in the business as an underwriter, managing our niche products business as well. So a little bit of operational experience thrown in there. But just sort of building on Belinda's point, which is that it's really important for everybody in the organisation to fill an element of responsibility for driving the strategy. I couldn't agree with that more because strategy is great, but making it actually executable requires a momentum of change, which brings the whole organisation on board. And what I wanted to talk about today is a question which I think is becoming increasingly important and relevant for the insurance industry, which is how do you build an insurance business that lasts 100 years? And it's something that we've been thinking about at IAG because our view is that actually there's a huge amount of risk out there at the moment. There is a huge amount of opportunity as well. But the reality is I think we're facing into a fairly disruptive environment. And what I want to share with you today is some thoughts on the fact that the business models that we've adopted in insurance, and I think it extends to general life and health, over the last few decades are not necessarily going to be the ones that enable us to succeed going forward. So I think it's a very interesting question to reflect on. And I thought, how better to start a presentation with some actuaries than to share some statistics with you? And no doubt you'll probably tell me they're wrong. But if you look at the average lifespan of publicly listed large organisations over the last 40 or 50 years, there's been a gradual decline. Back in 1970, the average lifespan of a large publicly listed organisation was around about 60 years. Today, it's somewhere below 30 years. In fact, I heard a quote yesterday from someone at Suncorp, actually, that said they've heard the average lifespan of a large listed organisation in the US is now only 16 years long. So there's something going on here which is causing, the big business models of the future to unravel. But if I was a chief executive running one of these businesses, buffeted by near-term change, the challenges of delivering against near-term earnings expectations, you could forgive me for probably not being overly concerned around what might happen in 30 years' time. But what would keep me awake at night is the fact that the probability of my business not existing in 5 years' time is now 30%. So that's a 1 in 3 chance that in 5 years' time, my business will either be bankrupt, wound down, or taken over by somebody else. So that's something that I think probably would keep me awake at night. So what's going on here? To set some context, I think it's just worth reflecting on the business models that insurance companies have adopted up until now. And the way we've thought about the business historically has been around what are the goals that we want to put in place for the organisation, and what are the 3 to 5 year strategic plans that we want to put in place to help us achieve those goals. And the way we've organised ourselves as an organisation to deliver on those outcomes is effectively through a value chain model, where, you know, we start with some raw material capital in our case, manufacture some products, push it down a pipe, and take it to our target market. And I would argue that's been a really efficient, effective operating model when you're trying to deliver a known outcome to customers. And it's worked very well in quite stable, relatively predictable environments. But I would also argue that the environment we're moving into now is a lot less predictable than it has been in the past. And that I think the whole value chain process has been designed predominantly for scale, for efficiency. The objective has really been to take as many products to customers as possible in as efficient a way as possible. And actually, kind of customers have not been at the center of that model. They've been tangential to the whole process. So the idea I want to share with you today is that I think that way of doing business is not going to fully go away, but I think the model's going to be less relevant and it's going to be less successful for insurance companies than it has been in the past. To be blunt, I think in a digitized world, it's becoming increasingly antiquated. And if you look at the impact that digital is having on insurance businesses, it's impacting in so many different ways across the entire breadth of the insurance value chain, but I want to highlight three specific things that I think are worth calling out. The first is that it's causing insurance value chains, and it's actually value chains in other industries, to fragment. We're seeing companies that are leveraging new digital technologies able to perform individual steps in the value chain much more efficiently and effectively than large conglomerates can do as an integrated chain. And I think we're seeing this play out particularly in the distribution component of the value chain. And in, you know, I guess one relatively simple example in general insurance is we're increasingly seeing a trend of the big motor manufacturers embedding motor insurance products into their vehicles at the point of sale. So for example, in Europe, BMW are now embedding a telematics-based insurance product provided by Allianz into their vehicles at the point of sale. So that's quite a disruptive thing for insurers to happen at the distribution end of their value chain. So that's the first key thing. The second key impact that digital is having on insurance value chains is it's causing them to increasingly become integrated with the value chains of other industries. And I think there's a tremendous blurring of boundaries taking place between industries. Historically, you know, we've thought about our value chain as being something that's quite sort of specific to, you know, insurance, and even within insurance, quite specific to a health insurance business, a life insurance business, or a general insurance business. Digital is now making it increasingly easy and cheap for businesses to connect with one another through what's called APIs. And that really is blurring the boundaries between industries. Big technology companies in particular are taking advantage of the connectivity and the reduced cost of connectivity that comes with digital to increasingly embed more services and more propositions into their model that go well beyond the scope of just a technology business. So we're seeing you know, the big technology companies, for example, play much more actively in the financial services space, particularly around banking at the moment. But my view is that's going to roll out over the course of the next few years into insurance as well. So increasingly, who we're competing with is a much more diverse set of competitors than we've thought about in the past. It's no longer just the traditional other insurance companies, whether they be local or global. In fact, it's the entire business landscape that we're competing with, and we need to increasingly think about how we work and how we collaborate with them. And together, those two things are really redefining how customers expect to experience financial services and insurance. Their expectations have been set by the engagement they have with big technology companies, and that's now being expected of insurance companies and financial services providers as well. And I would argue that customers are now increasingly expecting to be able to go to single point solutions to have a much more holistic need met by any one organization. And it's creating these big ecosystems to emerge, actually, which go beyond the scope of any one particular industry. And my view, my argument is that to succeed in that type of a world, you need to start thinking about your business as being less around a value chain and much more around the role you play in owning and orchestrating and participating in ecosystems and platforms that allow you to bring into your proposition a series of adjacent propositions from other industries. So what do I mean by an ecosystem? Well, in its most simple sense, I would argue it's a bunch of businesses coming together to take a proposition to customers, a solution to customers, which is beyond the capacity of any one organization to do on its own. And that's being made possible by digital platforms. It makes it much easier for the different components of that solution to be packaged together from different industries and taken to customers through a single interface. So over time, what I think might emerge is big ecosystems, for example, around mobility, around health, around shelter, where customers actually no longer just want to go to an insurance company to buy a motor insurance product or to buy a health insurance product or to buy a home insurance product. They want to go to an organization that can actually provide them with an integrated solution around their mobility need, or they want to go to a company that can provide them with an integrated solution around their shelter needs, whether that involves buying a house as well as insuring a house and maintaining a house, or they want to go to an organization that doesn't just sell them a health insurance product, but provides them with a solution for actually becoming a healthier, weller person. So that's a very, very fundamental shift in the role that insurance companies have been expected to play in consumers' lives, and I think requires a very different way of us thinking about our business and how we set ourselves up if we're going to be able to succeed and meet the expectations of customers in the future. And I thought I might just reference a couple of businesses in financial services, and particularly insurance, that I think are really embracing this principle and doing it quite well at the moment. And I'm not sure how familiar people here will be with the likes of Discovery in South Africa and Ping An in China. But in South Africa, Discovery, they started off as a health insurance business, but they're now an organization that's actually focused not just on selling health insurance products to customers, but bundling together a whole bunch of propositions that help customers lead a much healthier life. And they've put in place an incentive program and a reward program that acknowledges if you are becoming healthier as a customer, we're gonna incentivize you to do that through a rewards and a discount scheme, but we're also gonna acknowledge that in how we price your health insurance policy as well. So their focus has gone from being one which is about how do we use some traditional risk rating factors to price up a health insurance policy and then really manage the profitability of that policy through how we, how tightly we manage the supply chain, to being one that's much more focused on actually how do we manage the demand side of the equation and use an ecosystem vitality, ecosystem platform-based business model to actually change the demand dynamics in the market by making people healthier, which creates a win-win solution for both customers because they're healthier and creates better outcomes for Discovery because they're naturally being able to underwrite and attract a healthier cohort of customers. In China, Ping An have taken a slightly different approach to building out an ecosystem. What they're basically saying is their view is that insurance is going to increasingly be disintermediated, and the ownership of the customer in insurance is going to be owned by companies that are non-insurance companies that have access to the customer much earlier in their journey. And they've built out a whole ecosystem of adjacent products and services that really give them access to the customer much earlier in the buying journey so that they can embed their financial services products, of which insurance is one, into the customer at a much earlier stage in the journey, and at the same time capture a lot more data around what their customers are doing and use that to generate better products and services for their customers around insurance. So just a couple of examples of organizations that I think are embracing this concept and probably setting a bit of a standard for where I think insurance might be going in the future. And there's some evidence emerging. There's some early signs that these models are really the ones that are starting to attract the disproportionate share of economic value. So some of the latest research that's come out of MIT looks into the relative outperformance of ecosystem business models across a number of different sectors versus more traditional value chain models. And what they're finding is that ecosystem models are growing 30% faster than other business models, and they're doing so more profitably. Their margins are generally 20% higher. As well as delivering sort of outperformance from a financial perspective, they're delivering outperformance from a customer perspective as well. So their customer net promoter scores are about 15% higher than the comparable value chain models. And they're also able to deliver services and new products and innovations for customers in a much more agile and faster way. And on average, they're about 25% faster to market with new products and services than value chain models as well. So I think there's early signs that the value is shifting towards ecosystem business models. And just to leave you with some thoughts on what I think some of the different principles that apply to value chain businesses are versus ecosystem businesses, I think we need to start shifting our mindset from being one which is about how do we manufacture products and sell them to customers, to being one where actually how do we start to create solution for customers, of which an insurance product is just one aspect of that. I think we need to start shifting about our we need to start shifting the thinking in the business as being one which has historically been a relatively closed, tightly integrated value chain, where the attitude has been we can do most of it ourselves, with the exception of maybe leveraging some outsourced partners where it makes economic sense because it saves us some money, to being one where we open ourselves up much more and work with the community and third parties to help drive innovation and to drive much more collaboration. I think we need to think about innovation in much more than an incremental way. It's not just about how do we kind of develop new products and new service features for customers, but it's actually how do we take a different mindset, really understand customers' needs and curate solutions for customers in collaboration with partners through a more open business model. And I think that leads us away from a historic model of looking to establish point-to-point relationships with third parties, to being one where actually we're looking to coordinate and we're looking to orchestrate a whole community of partners that are working together to generate value within an ecosystem and deliver better solutions for customers than we could do if we were to work in isolation or on a point-to-point relationship basis with one another. So I hope that is some interesting thoughts. I'd love to hear what your perspectives are on kind of where the insurance industry is headed and whether this type of a model and this type of an approach makes sense to you. But hopefully that just gives you a little bit of insight into kind of some of the thinking that's taking place, at least at IAG at the moment, around what the future of insurance looks like and what it means for the way we operate as an organisation. So.
And now we'll have Belinda to finish off the presentations, and then we'll open up to general Q&A.
Hi, I work at Suncorp. Who's from Suncorp? I've got a few. Excellent. Good to see. Ross has stolen a little bit of my thunder, I must say. When I looked at his presentation, I actually had a lot of similar messages. So rather than going to the response end of what do we do, I thought it'd be interesting to spend a little bit of time unpacking the risks that we face. So the methodology that we use, we ask ourselves at Suncorp similar questions to our competitors. What does a successful, resilient, sustainable business look like? Now, to discover that, what we do, the approach we take, is we understand the strategic risks of the business. So we look at we try to understand what are the risks that could put us out of business, and then from that place, develop out strategic opportunities. And yes, we look at platform business models and new business models that are emerging, but we always start from a place of risk. Now, if I ask you the question, what do you think the strategic risks of the insurance business are? Any thoughts? Ross alluded to a few of them. Yeah, but what about customer engagement? Yep, yes. So, yeah, I think the way we would look at that is saying what's changing in customer behaviour that could be a strategic risk to us? Yep, absolutely. I think that could be one. Any others? Yeah, and I actually think the two, what you've both said, they're linked. So it's changing nature of customer expectations. And what you've called out is what we call the changes in mobility and the changes in home. If I think about the car, there's a tax on multiple fronts. So you've got software companies and OEMs radically developing technology of autonomous vehicles, which takes away the risk. Essentially, they want to get to a point where cars stop crashing. If you don't have cars that crash, what's the need for insurance, or is it radically reduced? Or does it change? Does cyber become the risk that is the new risk that we need to manage going forward? And also what you alluded to around people's changing behaviours and what do you do about that? So in terms of people owning cars, and we can see that there's multiple trends where people under 25 are not getting their licences like they used to, where people are radically taking up the use of ride sharing and car sharing. And the implications of, if you push that out to the nth degree, what that would do to our business. These are the types of things that we want to understand. We call them our strategic risks. About 5 years ago, Suncorp ran a very large process which involved over 200 years leaders from across the business to understand these risks. There was a bunch of actuaries that were involved in that process, and I've got to say they were very, very helpful in bringing a different perspective. Actually, a bunch of them joined our team in the strategic innovation when it was set up. But what they do, so we understand these risks, and what we do to help understand them is we form sense-making partners with people who are leading edge in understanding these changes, and we work with them to understand how that change is going to impact us, how quickly it's coming, and then also open up conversations about how we should respond. And so the response from Suncorp has been to shift its model from a value chain model to a platform model. We're looking to develop out an ecosystem of partners, and that's been expressed and shared to the market. Now, when we say that, what we're trying to do, it's a really big transformational and cultural shift to do that. You're essentially trying to run two businesses at the same time. Business one, which is the traditional one that's making all the money, which is driving all the profitability, has and values different things to what organisation two might need. And I mean that in terms of how it creates value for customers. So we all know how insurance creates value for customers, and we know how it captures value for customers. We know that we clip the ticket, we know that we manufacture the product, we get profit off it, and we know the capabilities that are required to do that. We need to have good risk management, good actuarial understanding, good people management, good claims, end-to-end management. And that looks really different from an organisation that is in the platform business. If I think of an example of a platform business, probably one of the best ones would be Google. So how do they generate value for their users? What do they do for us? Search. They make it really, really easy to search. And how much do they charge us for that? Absolutely nothing. They charge us nothing. So how do they make money? Because they're one of the most profitable businesses in the world. Advertising. So how they capture value, how they create value for their users is really different to how they capture value and how they make money. And platform businesses think like that. That's not how we think. We think in the old terms of we create value by selling this product or service and we capture value from the same user. This is a really different model, and so I think it creates extremely rich opportunity, but I wouldn't underestimate the cultural changes that are required to do that. So I guess the message for everyone is when you make shifts like this, and I think this is a message that everyone has shared, is you can't set up a team thinking all the same way in order to do that. You need different teams thinking differently to do it, and those teams have to be rich and diverse and have different perspectives. And the analytical perspectives that actuaries can bring, I've seen the value that that can create in teams that are thinking in this strategic space. Thanks.
Okay, we'll now have some roving mics around. And I invite the audience to ask questions. Just like I said, just please wait for a mic to come around and we can get started.
Hi, guys. Thank you, panelists, for that very thought-provoking presentation. If I may sneak in two questions. The first one's for Ross and Belinda. So I think it's very good that we're bringing awareness and a lot of understanding to the benefits of a platform ecosystem and how we want to get there. And I think as an industry, we do really well to sing the praises of new operators like you know, Trove or Hippo, Friendsurance or Lemonade. But I want to play devil's advocate, and I want to say that as an industry and from the big incumbents, we've been talking about this for years and years. What are the incumbents' appetite to just bringing something tangible to the market so that I could say, yeah, I'm really glad that IAG or Suncorp did this as opposed to an insurtech overseas? And the second question is for Megan, which is, I'm thinking about TPD products and life insurance, which is extremely profitable. You have a very, very loss ratio, and APRA is looking at it going, is, you know, they're making a lot of money. So what's the strategy around those kind of products? Thank you.
So the crux of the question was that you're looking to understand the appetite of organisations.
You're looking to understand the appetite of organisations to actually deliver. Yeah, so I mean, the way I would think about that is there is often a big trade-off between short-term wins and long-term strategic plays. And I'm not convinced, to be controversial maybe, that the startups are the place where you may win in this space. So the Troves and the examples there, a lot of those examples that you gave, I believe, are still operating in a product and service mindset, and they're not operating in a platform mindset. And so I think it will take time, and I think you're right, we still need to show and demonstrate the progress that we're making, but I think it would be a mistake to act too quickly and just go for the bright and shiny over really trying to develop out a strategy that works in the longer term.
So I think that there's real appetite within organisations to make this shift from value chain models towards platform ecosystem-based models. I think it's a lot easier said than it is done. I think that the approach will probably involve the organisation needing an increased appetite for failure, in fact, because there'll be lots of attempts that we make to try and, you know, achieve this transition that don't work out. So I think we need to, as an organisation, make sure that we're kind of ready to embrace failure and not let it distract us from the end goal and the objective that I really believe is the right one for us as an organisation to move towards, which is a platform ecosystem-based model. I think we're going to have to, I think the way to do that, I agree with Belinda, I don't think the startups are there yet, and I'm not sure I see a huge amount of disruption in the current startup world in insurtech around the sort of this platform ecosystem-based model. I think organisations need to think about creating a few different platforms and a few different ecosystems in a few different areas and having a bit of a portfolio approach and seeing what works. I actually think they have a lot of the ingredients and assets in-house to do this successfully. So very strong brands, huge customer bases, and quite rich data sets are three pretty good starting points from which to build out a platform ecosystem based model. But it's going to involve a change in culture within the organization, and it's also going to require quite a significant change in risk appetite, I would argue, at the board level as well. So I think the appetite's there. I think the ingredients are there to make it a success. I think it really boils down to actually can the organisation embrace and culturally embrace the change required to make that a reality. So that's the first thing. The second thing I would say is that I don't think it's going to be all about building and owning and controlling these ecosystems and platforms ourselves. I think the reality is we have to figure out as an industry how to successfully participate in ecosystems and platforms that are owned and controlled by other people. So, for example, the Amazons of this world, the Facebooks of this world, all the motor manufacturers are trying to move, you know, they view the car as a platform, they're trying to build ecosystems around the car. I think we're, you know, we're
we're kidding ourselves if we believe we're going to be able to own and control all of the ecosystems that we participate in. I think there's a lot of value to be created if we can find some opportunities to own and control them ourselves. But I think we need to figure out as an industry how we can participate in a value-creative way in other people's ecosystems as well, in a manner that doesn't just relegate insurance to become a utility commodity that's manufactured and sold through other people's businesses. And I think that's actually is equally difficult a challenge as it is creating and trying to own and orchestrate them ourselves.
So great question about TPD. So maybe I'd just make a couple of comments because you start off with a perspective about profitability of TPD. And I think one of the things that we know now, which is probably something that we didn't know maybe 5-10 years ago, is how correlated TPD experience is to unemployment. Because really, if you think about the genesis of TPD, what it's actually there to do is to help you if you're unable to work because of illness or injury and you can never work again. Depending on how well the economy is going and what your skills are, there's a lot of things that can overcome illness or injury, and particularly when you're faced with a claims assessment decision that's about giving you a large sum of money, there's a lot of incentive for customers to behave in a certain way also that they might not behave if the economic conditions are ripe. So, you know, it's a very cyclical product. But that's kind of a looking back view of the world. I'm probably more worried looking forward about the future of TPD when you think about future of occupations, right? I would pretty much hazard a guess that for most of you in this room, the occupation that you're thinking you might be doing in 20 or 30 years is not what you're going to be doing. And so if you think then about reinsuring somebody's occupation, effectively, your inability to do that occupation again, it's probably a lot of risk out there we don't actually know that we're taking right now. And so I think that's something that we've been thinking a lot about is how do we really drive innovation to be actually say, what are we really insuring against here? How do we help customers in their time of need? And there are some customers who do have permanency and will never work again. You know, that's absolutely true. But there's a lot of people who it's actually about helping them get back to work, helping them to reskill and so forth. And I think it's a similar kind of concept to this, you know, this ecosystem concept actually. People need help about getting back to work and about being their most productive and their most fruitful. And I think that's the exciting space for us as insurers to look ahead for, particularly for TPD.
So Michael Storager from Covermore Travel Insurance. So my question was about the third part of kind of that topic of disruptions to the insurance industry. And I think we hear a lot in the media at the moment about possible big disruptors, big shiny things here or that happening there, this new technology coming in and revolutionising the insurance industry. From your experience as strategy people, how do you assess the feasibility, the riskiness of some of these new hyped up ideas that are coming through when, say, the CEO or senior leaders are jumping up and down, pointing at this brand new thing, saying this is going to change the business. So how do you kind of articulate the riskiness, the appropriateness of it in kind of our market, and what thought processes go through your mind when assessing these new ideas?
Yeah, I'm happy to throw a couple of comments in. Look, I mean, I love new ideas, right? But the one of the things I love is something that we apply a lot at AMP is what's the problem we're trying to solve? A solution without a problem is always going to fail. So I think that's the first thing is to actually, you know, step back and say what problem are we trying to solve here and really spend a lot more time framing it and then really understanding what the options are before you actually commit to doing things. And then it's really about how do you test and learn fast. And, you know, that's a capability, I think, to this discussion about shifting capabilities that is a really hard capability to build in organisations that are highly regulated. You know, if you think about so much of what we do in our business is to make sure we're there for customers when they need us, and so they deserve this kind of ecosystem that protects them. It also is an ecosystem that makes failing fast really hard. So I think it's just, again, not being closed-minded to things, but being really open, but just being really clear on why are we interested in this and what problem are we trying to solve. So that'd be just maybe one perspective.
Yeah, I would agree. I think for us, we look and understand the change. I think what we do is we look at that change across the spectrum from is it probable to is it possible. Is it possible? Is it probable? So if it's possible, we want to understand it, but we want to be able to sort of take it in. But once it hits probable, when it's possible, you also want to be able to prepare. So by the time it hits probable, you're ready to act. And so we've got quite a strict methodology around that and understanding that sort of possible to probable. And it's not always perfect, I think, is the other thing. But I think you're right, Megan. It is about understanding. It's about iterating and experimenting and then sort of before you're putting anything too big into market. So you're not putting things into market that are set up to fail, essentially. And you can always cut them back if you need to. But it is, like I said before, a really big shift in how organisations have traditionally acted. So it's hard. Just need to tell those senior leaders to pipe down. And no, I'm joking. This is not on film, is it? It is on film. Awesome.
Hi. Just touching on a couple of points. We talked about the ecosystem environment and then the issues with regulation. How much do you think regulation is inhibiting the growth of insurance ecosystems? I'm thinking in particular, for example, like a Bupa example, where they're trying to get into other like health spaces like aged care and into owning ancillary providers. But they're not allowed to change their pricing around insurance because of the community rating system. So how can we change consumer behaviours and solve when we can't reward them for positive behavioural changes?
I'm happy to have a crack at answering it first. I think the regulatory question is a really good one. I think it's a bit of a double-edged sword. I think on the one hand, regulation has sheltered us to a certain extent up until now from disruption. It's been a bit of a barrier to entry for new incumbents. And the example you gave around, the community pricing restrictions around health insurance is a good example of that. I think the regulator is starting to change its tune though. So in Australia at the moment, the Productivity Commission are doing a review into competition and data use and availability. And if you just extrapolate what similar regulatory reviews have done elsewhere in the world, in Europe, in the banking industry, it's led to what's called Payment Services Directive 2 and a UK open banking regulation in the UK as well. And those regulations are really aimed at forcing the incumbent banks with huge data sets, huge customer access, to open themselves up more, to make it easier for new fintech companies to come in and innovate on top of their assets, leveraging their capabilities. It's designed to make it easier for other big industries to work more collaboratively with the financial services industry. So I think the regulator is increasingly viewing its role as being one that is actually trying to enable ecosystems to emerge by putting in place standards around how you use data and how that is made available more broadly to the customer and other people, so that fintechs and new startups actually have the ability to innovate and drive competition in the industry on behalf of the customer. So I think we've been in a world where up until now it's kind of worked in our favour from a disruption perspective. My sense is that some of the what we're seeing elsewhere in the world and what's happening in Australia with the Productivity Commission review at the moment probably going to lead to us moving into a much more open financial services environment around banking and insurance, which is probably designed to bring more competition into the industry and make it a bit easier for fintechs to get hold of the assets and capabilities they need to innovate better products and services on behalf of customers.
Hi. I just want to expand on the thought process when it comes to feasibility studies and stuff. Say if you have the board all in and wanting to expand on this ecosystem model, I guess the next thing to do is, in terms of partnership selection, who do you want to bring on board to form this sort of ecosystem, and at what point should you start internalizing and acquiring them? Could you maybe elaborate on what are the thought process, what are key considerations, and what are the risks when it comes to partnership selections?
So partnerships, selections, how do you choose? And do you build, buy or rent with that partner, essentially? And it's a really hard question to answer, I think. And what you need to start with is what business model are you trying to look at? How are you trying to create value for customers? How are you going to capture value for customers? And then look at the best solutions in order to do that. So I don't think it's as clear the cut as saying you should go out and just buy all these fintech startups, for example, or you should go out and just partner with them and maybe potentially open up your whole platform to be, and you just curate, although that may be the decision that you make, if it aligns to what you're trying to do at a business model level. But I think whenever you're going into a decision like that, you need to look at optionality around, should we build it, should we buy it, or should we rent it? And they're the questions that we ask ourselves day in, day out. And in order to do those feasibility studies, we do short discovery periods on the three options and put them side by side in light of the business model to make the decision. Does that answer your question?
I guess the only thing I would add to that is I think you've got to start with the problem you're trying to solve for the customer, and then you've got to say, well, you know, who does it make sense for us to partner with, buy, to help us solve that problem for the customer? And I think it also, I think you also just need to look at who are your current partners as well, actually. And, you know, my sense at IG is we've got a lot of established relationships in place with other organisations, but we've always viewed them as being quite transactional in nature. And I think there's a huge opportunity for us to actually start to think about how do we mould those partnerships into being something that's more strategic in nature, and thinking about rather than us just having a transactional relationship with you, if we were to work together to try and innovate and do something different for customers, what would that look like, just using the existing partners we've got today?
Thank you, panel. It's been a very exciting and thought-provoking discussion so far. And all of you have mentioned is culture as being one of the most important things to cultivate all the different ideas that you have. So my question is, we're all young actuaries here, and the truth of the matter is that we're not senior leaders yet. We are the everyman in an organisation. So my question is, for the everyman, what makes the everyman in an agile, sustainable, successful, innovative organisation? What are their characteristics and how are they different from the value chain, the big corps that we've got going at the moment? So what makes the everyman different between those two? And I'm guessing that's what actually flows up to make the organisation successful and innovative. Is that right?
I think that's a really, really good question. I think in the organisation one that I described, the things that are rewarded are hitting the KRAs that you've been set, sort of, you know, action, doing things, getting things done. The things that I don't know exactly what's going to be rewarded in number two, because it's still forming, but I suspect it will be capabilities around being able to think at a systems level. It will be able to understand strategy and complexity and handle complexity. And even sometimes saying, I don't think we should do that, I think we should hold off, which would not necessarily be rewarded in company one, because it doesn't align to a greater strategic goal that what I've heard. So the ability to sort of manage the, I'm not sure that that's the right thing to do. And I do think they're probably different skill sets as both. I mean, in number two, one thing that I know for sure, a very strong capability that is going to be required is data science, understanding and working with unstructured and structured data sets. These types of capabilities are absolutely, no matter what that platform business, those are capabilities that are going to be valued. So there's a bit on like culture and a bit on mindset, but there's also a bit like, yeah, mindset, but there's also just the hard capabilities that will need to be built out.
I think there's some elements of culture that will be consistent. So, you know, I think, you know, both organisations are going to need people that are good leaders. But I think probably one of the main differences is the need to break down silos in an ecosystem-driven business model. So, you know, you can't make ecosystems and platforms work if you're not part of a collaborative environment. And I think one of the biggest attributes and cultural characteristics that will make ecosystem environments successful is that the people within those businesses are really good at connecting with other people both inside and outside the organization, and you know, being able to think systemically to bring together different parts of the business and bring together people from outside the business to create something that would be otherwise impossible to do in isolation. So I think for me, one of the major differences in culture is probably going to be around the ability to collaborate and connect and break down silos.
I just might answer the question in a slightly different way. Many of you have probably heard, you know, quote, culture eats strategy for breakfast. I don't know if you've heard that. And I think that's been just a truism for so long. So I think if you look at who are the companies back that survived 100 years back on your graph, maybe Ross, 100 years ago, it's those companies that thought about the culture they wanted to deliver on their strategy and were purposeful and worked just as hard on their culture as they did on other capabilities in their business. And so I would say also maybe if you think about the startups who have become the overnight successes, actually what's made them great is their culture. So they've had a great idea, but actually being able to align, and that for everyone in their organisation to know why the culture matters and to be able to align that back to the purpose of the organisation, I think that's the true thing that's actually going to mean that companies will survive, you know, for 100 years going forward. Yes, you've got to have all the capabilities and the culture needs to enable that, but I think it's just being so thoughtful about culture just as much as it's thoughtful about the what it is you're going to do.
Hi, I had a quick question about kind of the disruption piece. So we've touched on the insurtechs and the challenges they face. So there's regulatory aspects, you need to get through APRA, you need to have at least $5 million of capital plus above that, so more than that, you need data to price things, all those challenges. There has been some relaxation of, I guess, regulation, especially from ASIC, regarding no longer needing an AFSL license or exemptions for that if you are writing contents, and that may expand into the future. I guess my question is, how long until there's a genuine new competitor to the IAGs and the Suncorps of the world, or will it be in 10 years' time what IAG and Suncorp is different, but it will still very much be a 3 or 4 player market? Considering that there is innovation labs for Suncorp and IAG and they are changing, and to use Trove as an example, it's an insurtech, but it's essentially Suncorp in the Australian market and Munich Re in the American market.
Do you want me to have a go? So if I think about Nokia, to answer your question, and why they went down, by 2007, 2008, they still had a dominant market share. They had all the pieces in parts to look at how you develop the best phones. They had smartphone technology. They had patents, the most amount of patents that you could ever imagine. And yet, within a 3-year period, they were absolutely dominated by Apple, because Apple took a platform approach to how it thought about this device and what it could do for you. Opening up all the apps, making it as something that you just couldn't live without. And for insurance, I think, you know, where does our big, you know, in the next few years, where could it come from? It could come from that type of approach, digitization of your cars and your homes and your life, that provides data that is very, very discreet and relevant, and you're able to understand risk better than we can ever understand, provides opportunity for people to come in and disrupt us. For me, I think they're the biggest risks of the next 5 years, and I guess we don't want to be another Nokia, is what I would say, because we do, and this is the thing about Nokia, they had all the bits, they just had to re-engineer how they thought about their business. They could have actually been the Apple, but they didn't handle it well. Does that answer it? Kind of?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. I think this is a very dangerous thing to say. It's hopefully won't eat my words in 5 or 10 years' time, but I would be really surprised if a new startup like Trove or Lemonade ended up being, you know, the thing that really fundamentally disrupted Suncorp or IAG. Just building on the example that Belinda gave, you know, Nokia got disrupted by Apple, and that to me is a great example of Nokia being disrupted by another large company that wasn't necessarily considered a competitor within their industry. So I think the biggest disruption threat to us over the next, you know, 5 years, give or take, is from other big incumbents that have much more intimate relationships with the customer than we do, suddenly deciding that it makes a lot of sense for them to start selling and bundling insurance into their propositions. And that could come from anywhere. It could be a big technology company, it could be a big motor manufacturer. But I think it's more likely that that's going to be, if there's anything that really knocks us off our perch, I think it's going to be that. I think I'd be really surprised if it was a new startup that we don't know about yet.
And in the US, Google is already looking to selling car insurance. Is selling car insurance.
Thanks. So two things. One, firstly, I think on the iPhone, there was no app store, maybe for the first year of the iPhone.
It came later.
Yeah. But that's anyway. But separately, so on your comment about that you think it's unlikely that a small startup will come to really challenge the current business model. So how do you view things like blockchain, so things that might be considered to be systematic challenges to insurance? Maybe they're falsely considered that way, but do you think that there are any real systematic disruptors that are out there that could challenge the business model? And this applies to life as well. So maybe you haven't spoken much, so just recently, because everyone's asking these GI questions.
But I mean, maybe genetic testing is a good example of that in the life insurance space. You know, we sit here and think about what might it look like, you know, for us to actually really understand what our health is going to be, what we need to do to manage it. But I think, again, it's like a driverless car. In a way, it says there's a new opportunity that comes off the back of that because it presents different risks and different things to, you know, to evaluate. So, you know, maybe that's one thing there. Look, I think, you know, it sort of goes back to, I think, what Belinda was saying, you know, early on, is that need to look so far out and say what could be those things that could be possibilities and keeping an eye on those things. Because forming a view today that some of those things are genuinely going to be disruptive is a very costly thing to running a business. You can't be looking at everything in the same, you know, the same degree of detail. And so that's really what strategy is about making choices about what you do and what you don't do every day. And so everyone's going to run a different risk appetite, a different view about it. And it's not, I guess it's just what are the risk indicators you're looking at that shifts it into that mode where you say, actually, we do need to accelerate activity on this and redeploy resources. So I think that's probably the way we've sort of been thinking about it, but without saying what might those things actually be. Does that answer George's say perspective anyway?
Yeah, I mean, the thing I would add about, if I think about blockchain, and it clearly could be very disruptive having contracts that are automated and involved in how insurance and other financial services is run. But I don't think blockchain in itself is going to be the disruptor. It's when blockchain combines with open data, combines with Internet of Things, combines with all of these other technologies that you are seeing that creates new business models that we haven't imagined before. That's where the disruption happens. So I think we try and keep an understanding of all of these things and how they're being used in different business models to form a perspective of how we might respond and utilise those in how we build out our businesses going forward.
Really fascinating discussion, and I don't know if this is just me, but for kind of young actuaries that are really interested in moving to a strategy field or kind of looking to kind of move into, say, one of your teams, I think it's very easy for a lot of us to be very tunneled in our view of the company. It's we do reserving all day or we do pricing all day, and that's our vision How do we branch out to other parts of the business to get that holistic view that I think seems to be quite imperative to be successful in a strategy team?
I can have a go.
So I started out in accounting, and I spent a number of years in accounting, and I thought, you know, it was good and gave me a really good understanding of profit and loss statements and balance sheets and how companies are run. But I thought longer term, you know, this is not something that I want to do for my whole life. And so, but I thought, you know what, these skills could probably be applied elsewhere in this business. And so I opened conversations with people. I formed relationships with people. I went out of my way to leave that tunnel vision and donate my time out of hours to doing things that I thought were interesting to me and interesting to others. Then I moved into a marketing function where I applied my skills in terms of understanding and developing data and data analytics for campaigns. And then I moved into a strategy function, and I've been there for a number of years, and then I moved into strategic innovation. So I think it comes down to a bit of luck and serendipity and being at the right place at the right time, but I think it also comes down to saying, what is it I want out of my life and what do I value and how am I going to make that happen?
Thanks for buying me some time. I've been on a similar journey. I started off actually as a geographer, believe it or not. That was what I qualified with a degree from university in geography, and then spent a few years, you know, trying to figure out how to make money as a geographer, which didn't take me very far. So I went into chartered accountancy, and then I went did some time in banking, and have ended up in strategy in an insurance company. I guess the only piece of advice I would give, if that's where you're interested in going, is being curious. I think curiosity is a really, really valuable characteristic to have, and I think to succeed in strategy, you need to be someone that is curious and is interested in understanding new ambiguous concepts and trying to make meaning out of them. And if that's something that excites you, and if that's something that appeals to you, I think, you know, you'll probably be someone that will find strategy quite an interesting space to work in. And I'd encourage you to find as many opportunities as you can to get some exposure to it. And I think how you do that has to depend on, you know, your organisation and what opportunities are there for you.
And I think actually picking up the phone, going and asking somebody, being curious, I think that's the word. Finding there's always projects on, people need help, volunteering, giving your time, all of those things are really critical. And I think that's, you know, how those opportunities get created. But even in the role you're in today, what's the extra edge? You know, if you're doing some pricing, how do you throw a bit in there that says you've been thinking about something that's far related? You know, we've all got to write a pricing report that sets out the risks. Maybe put a few risks out there that are not 10% increase in claims rates. You know, how do you put an edge? Because that's what gets you noticed. That's what will people come and ask. Oh, why did you say that? What have you been thinking about? And that's really building those relationships based on curiosity and applying a bit of thought to beyond what it is the task you're doing is, I think, the most important way to do that. And I also come back to not just strategy people do strategy. Lots of business people get involved in strategy, and I think every role you do, you should be thinking about what am I doing here, what skills am I building, what capabilities, and how am I stretching my strategic thinking or my my analytical skills, my business acumen, my leadership skills. Everybody in an organisation is a leader, because every person in an organisation can influence somebody. So think about yourself as a leader and think about how can I influence people. So I think every job you should be looking at what are those skills, and then it's just what you happen to be doing that day is actually where you get the experience.
One thing we didn't get to focus on, although we did touch on a lot of areas, was probably just how much technology is evolving. And so you covered some of this in your presentation, Ross. But one question I might have is, you're starting to see certain platforms like Alexa, like Google Home, really take off in the States, but they haven't come to our shores yet. So my question is, I guess twofold. So is there an opportunity to partner in that space? And secondly, where might you see actuaries deploy their skills in that area to the benefit of the also just for their own skill set as well.
So I don't mind having a go at that. In terms of the connected home, you're right, a lot of the technology is still in the US, but last year there was $400 million spent in Australia on smart devices in the home, on smart TVs, smart washing, smart fridges, smart washing machines. And in the next 3 years, it's projected that that's going to increase 10 times. So by 2020, it's going to be 10 times that, $4 billion. So does that look like an opportunity? Possibly. I think that's probably, accountant, looks like 10 times, probably not a bad opportunity. Can you dominate in that? It's probably not our core capability. Should you partner? Could be one possibility. In terms of how you deploy that, if your company chooses to go into connected home, connected car, those types of spaces, like I said before, the way that you understand and look at data is going to be absolutely critical to identify those key customer interactions that matter and value to people to offer more value on top of that. And so those skills are going to be required if that's where your company decides to, or the strategy your company decides to pursue.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. The battle for the home is, I think, one that is still really uncertain as to how that's going to play out. I think it makes sense for insurance companies to be placing some small bets with, you know, how they participate in Alexa, how they participate in Google Home. But I think the big utilities companies are trying to do quite a bit in this space in the UK. British Gas has created a whole platform around the home as well. So I think it's really uncertain how it's going to play out. In terms of the second part of your question, Cam, around what it means for actuaries, just building on Belinda's point, you know, I think however it plays out, we're going to end up getting a huge amount of more data into the organisation through whatever strategy we take. And, you know, if it's on Alexa or if it's on Google Home, that's going to create a huge amount of more data for us to be able to, access and use to understand our customers and you know, sort of what's important to them. And I think the actuaries have got a really, really important role in helping us think through how we actually get the most amount of value out of all of this new data that we're going to be getting as we move into a digital world.
And understand risk, how it changes risk.
I'd like to invite you all to thank Megan, Ross and Belinda for dedicating their time to us and giving some great advice. To let you know, we've got a few YAP sessions coming up later in the year, including our open night and a chance to focus a bit more on data analytics as well. Thanks, guys.
Trying to give them more flexibility in actually using, you know, whatever is their home insurance. So they try to give it to the agents, but they try to still create a system.
and survived, but it, that was the only, it needed to get to that point before they were able to change. Most of my colleagues actually get death insurance. I actually get DI because of the 30-day waiting. KPMG free insurance. So that's a need, but a lot of people are actually getting, but they want the platform benefits rather than the actual insurance benefits. That's actually a very good thing. And I think that ties in what you said about people. You said in your surveys, people get insurance in general or life because but is that the only reason? Especially with life insurance, especially life insurance, it's not your general insurance where you get a mortgage,
Not always.
They need So I can name one or two people on my hand that are like that in my company, but by and large, I would say so. They have their particular visions. It's hard to imply, and it's a bit of flattery. It's sort of like it shows they value
and sort of getting up around regulations.
You're getting customers. Yeah, exactly.
I was looking at the world.